Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Sunday. It is Oscar night. Kind of just started and thought I'd do some gossip galore and start off with South by Southwest. And, you know, Megan was there on the panel. And then people kind of started looking through everything. And basically, Megan bought her way onto the South by Southwest center stage panel. The 19th, which was an organization, was partnering with the Archewell Foundation. So basically, Megan paid for everybody to be there along with this other organization, like Katie and Brooke Shields and Nancy Wang Yuan and Aaron Haynes. And it wasn't also a great sign that the roundtable occurred on the first day of the festival, because most of the people attending hadn't even got there yet. So it was probably one of the cheapest slots available. And then after South by Southwest, you know, the night before they'd gone to Soho House, have to prop up that yachting enterprise, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle paid what they deemed, wanted everybody to know, was a surprise visit to Uvalde, Texas. They went yesterday, but it wasn't a surprise. Because if you look in the background of the pictures, everybody's all dressed up. Everybody knew that they were coming. It wasn't a surprise. But they met with the Garcia family, who lost their mom, Irma, the matriarch, a teacher at Robb Elementary School, and then her husband, who died days later, with believed to be because of a broken heart. So Irma's nephew revealed that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex paid him and his family a surprise visit. Shared photos of Meghan speaking with him on the driveway, his home. Also another, like, a selfie, and then another photo inside the house. But if you look at the ones, especially the selfie, you can see that there's a lot of other people there, and they're all dressed up. So obviously, it wasn't a surprise. But the nephew said it truly meant the world that Harry and Meghan showed up to visit the family. There were lots of tears of joy and heartfelt moments. They were the kindest, most humble people ever. It was like having family and friends over, having an amazing time together. They fit right in. We laughed a lot and shared intimate memories together. It's all staged. They went, and this family, obviously, whatever kind of grief and support that they can get, I'm all for. It was a horrible tragedy, especially this particular family. But it just, why couldn't you just keep it a secret? Why do you always have to have the attention? That's the thing. The other thing is, earlier today, because it's Mother's Day in the UK, so Kensington Palace shared a photo of Kate Middleton, supposedly the first official image of the Princess of Wales released since her surgery in January. The story went that the picture was taken by Prince William earlier this month, and it shows Kate surrounded by her three kids, and was accompanied by a brief note thanking the public for their support as she recovers. Thank you for your kind wishes and continued support over the last 2 months. Wishing everyone a happy Mother's Day, and she signed the note with her initial C. And, you know, if you look at Kate in the photo, she's wearing some jeans and some boots. She's not wearing any jewelry. No wedding and engagement ring. So it's out there for a few hours. Then the Associated Press sent out a kill notification. And it says in this kill notification, clients, please be advised that the following story has been killed and should no longer be used. Story title, UK Royals Princess. Story number, gives the number, the date of original transmission, and the reason for killing the story. At closer inspection, it appears that the source has manipulated the image. No replacement photo will be sent. Please remove it from all platforms, including social, where it may still be visible. You're receiving this email because the Associated Press is now serving notice of video kills to customers via an operational email. This change will ensure all needed parties are aware of any relevant issues with AP video content. And no explanation from the palace was provided. Just all gets more mysterious. Also mysterious is Barbie 2. Margot Robbie has made it very clear she does not want a Barbie 2. I've talked about it on the podcast, that Margot does not want it. But I've also talked about it on the podcast and also blinds that Greta Gerwig does. And there was a very interesting kind of statement from the Warner Brothers chief, Pam Abdi, who said she would love to make a sequel to the box office blockbuster Barbie because the original movie, quote, ignited audiences around the world. She is the co-chair and CEO of Warner Brothers Motion Picture Group, and she told the BBC that Warner Brothers and Barbie director Greta Gerwig were always talking about the prospect of following their success with another outing to Barbie's unique world. Doesn't mention anything about Margot. The BBC also reports that Gerwig, who adapted the screenplay for which she is nominated with her husband Noah Baumbach, said earlier this week she's open to the idea of making a sequel if she can find an undertow for the movie. It's up to Margot. Margot says no. So this is going to be interesting to watch. I said that there's just no way that Warner Brothers is going to pass on something that made $1.5 billion. Of course, they're going to want to try and make a sequel. But maybe we could just let it go. Now, in one of the more interesting visits to a club this weekend, NeNe Leakes was out in a club in Atlanta. And she was with Marlo Hampton. Makes sense. That's one of her closest friends. But also in the group was Portia Williams' estranged husband, Simon. And after NeNe posted the video on her Instagram, Portia posted a message on her Instagram saying, "We are not on Earth long enough to live unhappily." Very, very interesting. Also unhappy is China Phillips. Now, obviously, working on a deep dive on China Phillips and the whole Phillips family, but China's coming up, you know, after Michelle and John. So I wanted to get this out there because she is talking once again about a video that she first posted back in 2020 and about a sexual assault that she said that she endured as a teen, claiming she was raped by a man who then drugged her and held her hostage for days. She said it happened on her 18th birthday, that she started the night off partying alongside her closest friends in L.A., but then she decided to separate from them to buy some cocaine and was raped by the drug dealer. She says, "Hey, I drank an immense amount of straight vodka during the bash. Then I went to a male friend's house to try to buy drugs. It's really shameful and embarrassing to admit, but I really wanted to do cocaine that night. I was determined to get my hands on some cocaine." She referred to the man as Doug, which is not his name. But she said she arrived at Doug's house, that he told her that she didn't look well and needed to lay down. She agreed that she didn't feel well, passed out in his bed, but awoke sometime later to Doug getting on top of her. Suddenly the door swung open and Doug walked in. I opened my eyes and all I could see was that he was taking his belt off and he was pulling his pants down. I was confused. I didn't know what was happening. I couldn't speak. I was so drunk that I could not speak. Doug proceeded to rape me and I could not get a word out. I kept saying in my mind, trying to tell him to get off of you, but nothing was coming out of my mouth. So I just waited for it to be over. Then he put his pants back up, put the blankets back over me, and I just passed out again. And then she woke up the next morning, Doug brought her breakfast, and that she now believes he put drugs in the meal. She said, "I felt drugged. I just really felt out of it that whole day. I think that Doug had been drugging me." She said she spent the entire weekend at his house and was out of it the whole time. Nobody checked on her. Nobody was looking for her. Ugh. "I feel like I've been held hostage there that whole weekend. I don't even know how I got home. I just remember putting on my pajamas after I got home, getting under my covers in my bedroom and crying and crying and crying. It's a horribly sad story. I totally feel for her. You know, your 18th birthday is supposed to be magical. And instead, it has basically caused, as she refers to it, a stain on her life. I mean, she's 56 now. 38 years she's been dealing with this. Now, not being dealt with for 36 years, but for a while anyway, is The Holdovers. And on the eve of the Oscars last night, The Holdovers, which is going to win Best Screenplay, it's been basically accused of being plagiarized line by line from a decade-old screenplay for a film written about 10 years ago that was never made. Simon Stevenson, best known for working on Luca and Paddington 2, sent out emails to the Writers Guild of America. And he says that The Holdovers director Alexander Payne likely read a script for his eerily similar movie Frisco when it made the rounds around Hollywood in 2013 on the industry's blacklist of most liked scripts. And it peaked at number 3. And he said the evidence The Holdovers screenplay has been plagiarized line by line from Frisco is genuinely overwhelming. Anybody who looks at even the briefest sample pretty much invariably uses the word brazen. That's what Stevenson wrote in the email that he sent to the WGA director of credits. Now, Frisco is a drama that follows a cranky children's hospital worker who gets stuck watching after his 15-year-old student. Paul Giamatti plays a prep school classics teacher who spends a Christmas break with a troubled teen, played by Dominic Sessa, and the school's cafeteria manager, played by Divine Joy Randolph. And Stevenson compares the two films scene by scene, and also sequences and dialogues. And he says that Payne reviewed the Frisco script in 2013 and had it again in late 2019 before he approached first-time film writer David Hemsingin about the holdovers. Hemsingin also received producing credits for the movie. But Stevenson wrote, "I can demonstrate beyond any possible doubt that the meaningful entirety of the screenplay for a film with WGA-sanctioned credits that's currently on track to win a screenwriting Oscar has been plagiarized line by line from a popular unproduced screenplay of mine. I can also show that the director of the offending film was sent and read my screenplay on two separate occasions prior to the offending film entering development." He said that only five parts from The Holdovers are not in his Frisco script, including, ironically, a backstory about someone getting away with plagiarism. He said, "By meaningful entirety, I do mean literally everything. Story, character, structure, scenes, dialogue, the whole thing. Some of it's just insanely brazen. Many of the most important scenes are effectively unaltered and even remain visibly identical in layout on the page." But the WGA said, "We can't do anything. You got to go to court." Now, Payne has won two Academy Awards for Best Adapted Screenplay, so it shows he knows how to adapt a screenplay. He won for Sideways and The Descendants. Now, there's some sad news in the adult entertainment world, and I feel like I could talk about something like this at least once a week. But adult film star Sophia Leone has died after she was found unresponsive in her New Mexico apartment on March 1st. She was 26. And there's a GoFundMe page set up to honor her. Sophia was a beloved daughter, sister, granddaughter, niece, and friend. She had a deep love for all animals, specifically her three pets. She enjoyed traveling and always found ways to make everyone around her smile. The LA-based modeling agency 101 Modeling said that her death was being investigated as a robbery and homicide. But there have been a lot of porn star deaths. And I don't know what the average life expectancy of a porn star is. Somebody said it was 37 years old not that long ago. There's so many porn stars, I don't even know how you could keep track and find out exactly what their life expectancy is. But the industry is rife with abuse. It feels like there is so much porn out there and there are so many people doing it. And a lot of these porn stars are already sex assault victims or been abused in their childhoods. I mean, in February, we had Cagney Lynn Carter, who had struggled with mental health. She died of a suicide. She shot herself. You had Tanya Fields, who I think I did talk about. She basically was discovered in her home in Peru back in January. And her last post on social media showed her standing by a Christmas tree while talking to the camera. And she had shared harrowing abuse claims a year ago in an interview with the YouTube channel Emojis TV. And she said at the time, "It's very strong. At first I said that I couldn't sue, and many thought that by hiring me they could do what they wanted with me. But then I came home, took a bath, and cried. He told me that I had to be strong and let it go. It happened to me so many times. It's very difficult to be a woman and create adult content when society is literally in trouble." Yet Sophie Anderson, not that long ago. She's a British adult actress. She died at age 36, just weeks after her boyfriend, Oliver Spedding, also an adult entertainer. And Anderson brought kind of adult entertainment to the mainstream in the UK. And she worked a lot with HIV charities, LGBTQ plus community. And like I said, it was shortly after the death of her boyfriend, a former soccer player who had joined the adult entertainment industry. And they had lived and worked together. They had a volatile relationship. Spedding had been arrested by police last year on suspicion of causing Anderson grievous bodily harm. And after his release, he posted a hoax death announcement for Anderson, but she forgave him, said, "I know things have been put online and assumptions have been made, but he's not the bad one. His silly joke about me being dead was only because everyone keeps bombarding him with messages like he has hurt me, and he never has done. It was a stupid joke, and he's sorry." We had Jesse Jane, not that long ago. One of the biggest, adult entertainment actresses of all time. She had been a Hooters waitress and a beauty pageant contestant, and then went on to star in the highest budget series in pornographic film history. And she died of a drug overdose, along with her boyfriend. They were both found dead. But she was best known for her work in the Pirates movie series, in which she played the first officer on a ship of sailors who go after a band of evil pirates. And Digital Playground spent $1 million on the first film in 2005 and $8 million on the 2007 sequel. And she said, I got into porn right at the perfect time when porn stars mattered. They were big and glamorous. You walked into a room, you turned heads. Everybody knew who you were because they actually had to buy your product or DVDs. Everything. Porn was so naughty, but everybody watched it. But she said the internet killed the business. It has, and now there's millions of porn stars instead of thousands. So now the only people that get noticed are the people who go for shock value. If you ever want to see her in something that's not porn, you can go watch Starsky and Hutch or Entourage. The Entourage episode is the one where they go to Comic-Con, and she's there. So, and kind of has a fairly large part in it. Emily Willis? I mean, she's fighting for her life right now in a vegetative coma after being found unresponsive at a rehab facility in Malibu where she was being treated for addiction. She's 25. She'd been at rehab for 8 days when she suffered cardiac arrest on February 5th. She was rushed to a hospital, remains in a coma and on a ventilator. Originally, people said that she suffered an overdose, but her stepdad said that an early toxicology screen came back negative. He said, regarding the reports of an overdose, we want to clarify that they're not accurate as far as the doctors and my family know. Emily was receiving the treatment and help she needed at the time of the incident to overcome her struggles. So let's move from that and that horribleness to Jim Ross, who kind of wants to just kind of sweep all the Vince McMahon stuff under the carpet. And on his podcast this week, Grilling JR, he addressed the situation with McMahon following the allegations that were made in Janelle Grant's lawsuit. She, of course, accused McMahon of physical and emotional abuse, sex assault, sex trafficking. But Jim Ross said, I just never believed that Vince would allow his company to get this out of control, and it has. But he said it's time to move on and get some rest and peace for some people. His quote was, lots of change afloat, and personally, I'll be glad when the winds have swept that change on through. I'm tired of it. It's embarrassing in a lot of ways that it's happened this way. It's affected a lot of innocent people. That's my take on it. I might be wrong. But it's time to move on. It's time to move on and cause some rest and peace for some people. And it's time to move on, in my opinion. And I just never believed that Vince would allow his company to get this out of control, and it has. And I feel badly about that because I know how much the WWE meant to Vince. I'm sure it still does to some degree. So anyway, it's time. Let's go. Let's move on. Let's rewind it and cast the hook in the water one more time and see if we can catch something more positive. But the co-host, Conrad Thompson, asked Ross, hey, how do you think this is going to affect Vince McMahon's legacy? He said, well, it'll affect it to some degree, but it won't be earth-shattering. It won't be a big seismographic change because he's still Vince McMahon, and he's still built this amazing company that many of us in different forms of pro wrestling are still celebrating and still playing off of. I just think it's time for all of us to move on and find happier days and build from there. But you'll never be able to take away from what Vince built and how he's helped a lot of people. I mean, a lot of guys that are making a living in pro wrestling right now can look at it any way they choose, but if they're being realistic, they look in the mirror and see Vince McMahon staring them right in the face because he was the catalyst that created a lot of this change and the income's going up and all those things. So I just wish it was over. I just wish we were moved on and all these issues were settled and we've moved on to happier days, because I think that's what the business and the world needs is happier days, and still get that with the old WWE memories. At least I do. Well, I'm sure that this guy knew everything that was going on. I mean, he was at one point he was the executive vice president of talent relations for WWE. But he says, I'm very thankful I had the chance to work there. I'm even more thankful I have a chance to work for Tony Khan. So it's all good, man. It's all good. We have to build on the positives. And that's what I'm trying to do at my stage of life and my health situation. It's important for me to build on the positives, and that's what I'm trying to do. And Ross just got his contract renewed for a year. I'm glad that there's been some, finality in the Jackson Mahomes thing. He's been sentenced to 6 months probation, and he also got a jail sentence that was suspended in a case about an assault on a woman. But he appeared Thursday for a sentencing hearing via video conference. Pleaded guilty to a single misdemeanor count for battery. And the sentencing came more than 2 months after prosecutors dismissed 3 felony charges for aggravated sexual battery, which I've talked about on here. And those more serious charges were dropped due to a lack of cooperation from the woman, a.k.a. got a check. But after, like right after he sentenced for this horrible thing, he went on Instagram and shared a mirror selfie. And then when there, you know, all the outrage, he deleted it, but everybody screenshot it, shared it. You see, you can tell he just doesn't care. It's like, ah, I got my brother. What do I care? Nothing's going to happen. 6 months of probation. Come on. Now, if you read the site, if you listen to me here, you will have heard me say that Jennifer Lopez is going to be in for a world of hurt on her concert tour. That she's just not going to be able to sell out the arenas that she thinks she is. She should just do a Vegas residency, stay in one place, have people who want to see her come to her rather than going all over the country trying to fill up 10 to 15, 20,000 seat arenas. And now she's canceled 5 shows. Just no explanation, just boom, let me cancel 5 shows in August. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that. If they were sold out, she wouldn't have canceled them at all. And I think that there's going to be a lot more. She thinks, hence the nickname that I've given her, A-list everything in her mind celebrity. She just thinks that she's more popular than she is. This is not 2004. This is not 2005. This is 2024. There's just not enough people that want to see her dance around on the stage lip syncing. Now, some good news. An LA jury says Ricky Garcia from the boy band Forever in Your Mind was indeed sexually abused by his former manager back when the singer was a teenager. The jury came back with a verdict Friday, finding Joby Hart liable for childhood sexual abuse, gender violence, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. The jury also hit Hart with a 7-figure judgment, awarding Ricky $5.5 million in compensatory damages and another $1 million in punitive damages. Ricky was 20 years old back in 2019 when he filed the lawsuit. It took 5 years. And in the lawsuit, he alleged that Hart had groomed and assaulted him for several years, starting when Ricky was just 12. And Ricky joined Forever in Your Mind after auditioning for season 3 of The X Factor. Simon Cowell loved him, got an invitation to join the group. He was also a child actor, started more than 30 episodes of Best Friends Whenever on the Disney Channel. But in his lawsuit, he said that Hart took the band on trips he described as songwriting sessions, and the singer says Hart got him drunk and he woke up naked on Hart's bed. On other occasions, Ricky says Hart forced him to perform sex acts while he was under the age of 18. He said he was afraid he'd lose his career, so he remained silent for years until he and his mother confronted Hart and then filed the lawsuit against him. You might not be aware of it, but this week marks the 40th anniversary of the release of Splash. It was 40 years ago yesterday. I mean, that was Saturday, March 9th, but it was on a Friday, probably. You had Madison, played by Daryl Hannah. Alan Bauer, played by Tom Hanks. It was the first film to be released by Touchstone. That was the Walt Disney Company's new thing. You always knew you were going to get a little bit more risque when you got the whole Touchstone Pictures. Like a little bit more mature themes. And the tagline for Splash was, "She was the woman of Alan's dreams. She had large dark eyes, a beautiful smile, and a great pair of fins." But, you know, Daryl Hannah goes, "You know, it was so embarrassing. I was really naive." And she, you know, talks about like the scene when she kisses Tom Hanks. And when she was rehearsing with director Ron Howard, she says she kept skipping over the kiss moment out of sheer awkwardness. Because once you do it once, then it's easier to get through the next time. But that first time when you don't know somebody and you have to kiss them is so embarrassing, at least for me it was. And, the way that this movie was made. I mean, Brian Grazer knew that, you know, creating a believable underwater world was going to be a challenge. But he and Ron Howard said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to shoot underwater in the Bahamas. And they had an underwater cinematographer, Jordan Klein. And they mapped out every scene on storyboards. They had 16 days they could film there. And the actors underwent a bunch of preparatory training because they had to dive down like some 50 feet. And they had to adapt to not using standard diving equipment while in costume. And, I mean, Daryl Hannah basically had nude scenes in a Disney movie, but there wasn't really any nudity. But she said, hey, I was really anxious. I was very world traveled, but very sheltered at the same time. I hadn't really had a boyfriend yet, so I was incredibly anxious about any nudity. But she said Ron and his team came up with my hair covering my boobs because they didn't want me to have any kind of, I don't know, shell bathing suit top or anything, which I understood. And for underwater scenes, I would just make sure to have my hair taped down to my breasts. And she said that she loved filming the whole thing, especially in that mermaid tail. But she said it was incredibly painful out of the water. But underwater, she said it was magical. It, you know, to get the tail on took around 5 hours. And then they would film underwater for like 6 hour stretches. And she had to be able to hold her breath as well as manage like her movement and vision in the ocean. But she could swim as far as 120 feet with her mermaid tail. And they had a stunt swimmer there, Mike Nomad. Daryl could do it in the water, even without a mask. And towards the end of the filming in the water, Nomad said that Hannah turned to him and said, I don't know how people can swim with just feet. I've gotten so used to the tail that I've forgotten how to swim without it. Tom Hanks, Eugene Levy, John Candy was one of the highest grossing movies in 1984. Got an Academy Award nomination for Lowell Gans, Babalu Mandel, and Bruce J. Freeman's original screenplay. And I mean, Hannah's had a pretty quiet career. I mean, right after that, she did Roxanne and Wall Street and Steel Magnolias and Kill Bill, but it's been pretty sporadic. In the whole wake of Malaysian Airlines 370, there's all these airline stories now, airplane stories. And there is an Indonesian airline called Batik Air. And basically, they flew around with 159 people on board asleep. They were asleep, the pilot and the co-pilot. And it happened back in January. And this Indonesia's National Transportation Safety Committee found that this flight began to divert from its flight path when both the pilot and his first officer, who were not publicly named, dozed off for around 28 minutes. So after reaching cruising altitude during the flight, which was 2 hours and 35 minutes from the island of Southeast Sulawesi to Jakarta, the 32-year-old pilot in command asked his 28-year-old deputy for permission to sleep. After getting approval from his second in command, the captain fell asleep for an hour, woke up briefly to ask the 28-year-old if he wanted to switch places. The younger first officer declined the offer. The captain went back to sleep only to wake up 28 minutes later to find that the aircraft was not on the correct flight path and that his partner was napping. And once the captain woke up, he was able to get the plane back on the correct path, landing at Jakarta. Nobody was injured. Nobody was even really new. But during the time the pilots were asleep, Jakarta's air control center noted that it had made several calls to try and contact the pilots, but they were only met with silence. So officials interrogated the pilots. The first officer claimed he'd been busy taking care of his one-month-old twins in his new home and has been struggling to get enough sleep. Now, the captain and the co-pilot had been deemed fit to fly prior to the trip, passed health checks, passed alcohol tests, and they have been temporarily suspended. My goodness. They just fell asleep, both of them. For whatever reason, French President Emmanuel Macron has decided that this week is, for whatever reason, he's taking a stand about his wife and whether Brigitte was born a man and is transgender. And it's crazy that he's talking about it so much, and his stepdaughter, who never gives interviews, like 2 weeks ago, also was talking about it. Now, Macron said the worst thing is the false information and fabricated scenarios. People eventually believe them and distribute even into your intimacy. And his stepdaughter said, I have concerns about the level of society when I hear what's circulating on social networks about my mother being a man. The confidence of what is affirmed and the credit given to what is proclaimed. Anyone can say anything about anyone, and it takes time to get it taken down. True that. And last summer is when there was a court in France and it handed down a judgment and a defamation lawsuit against two French women, Amandine Roy, who's a psychic, and Natasha Ray, who's a freelance journalist. And they made a 4-hour YouTube video back in 2021 and said that Brigitte Macron was born as a baby boy called Jean-Michel Trognon in 1953, but that is actually the name of the First Lady's brother. And they also said that her first husband had never actually existed before he died in 2019. They said that Jean-Louis Alzire, Andre Louis's uncle, Andre Louis's uncle, had forged administrative documents to hide that his wife had given birth to all of Brigitte's three children. So the court awarded Macron and them money. They got $1,500. Now, the Macrons, obviously, they first met when Brigitte was 40. And Macron was 15 years old, in class with Brigitte's daughter. And the French age of consent is 15. But Brigitte was concerned about how her relationship with Macron and how it would affect her kids. She said, I took time so I would not wreck their lives. That lasted 10 years, the time to put them on the rails. You can imagine what they were hearing, but I didn't want to miss out on my life. So basically, she's saying that they did hook up when he was 15 and she was 40. You know, I don't know. Well, it wouldn't be Oscars without talking about something Oscar-centric. And I want to go back in time to The Moonlight and La La Land. That whole controversy in 2017. There's been a lot of drama in the Academy Awards, but at the end of the 89th Oscars on February 26, 2017, the wrong Best Picture winner was announced. And there's been a lot of interviews with people and stuff like that, but I'm just going to summarize my theories. What about Leonardo DiCaprio getting back at the Oscars? You know, little prank. I wouldn't put it past him because he probably didn't think anything of it or it'd be that big of a deal. But when you watch La La Land, you know, mistakenly be announced as Best Picture instead of Moonlight. But who was to blame? Warren Beatty's taken most of the flack. You know, there was things that he said that, you know, he couldn't read the teleprompter and things like that. Faye Dunaway had been just crazy out of sorts all week. And she's the one who declared La La Land the victor because Warren Beatty was stalling. Was it a stagehand who monitored the envelopes? Maybe. But what about Leo? Now, just moments before he presented Emma Stone with the award for Best Actress, and he left the stage with the red envelope for that award on that night. And then moments later, chaos ensued, and now people think, well, maybe he had something to do with it. Now, Emma Stone said she took the envelope backstage. Okay. But there are two envelopes that exist for security purposes. So maybe Leo did slip it to Warren Beatty. Then there's the theory about Jimmy Kimmel. Maybe. But PricewaterhouseCoopers, the longtime accounting firm, took responsibility, released an apology statement. But they said Dunaway and Beatty were apparently given the envelope and card for the Best Actress category, which read Emma Stone La La Land. Thus the confusion. Okay, so did Leo do that? But they said the presenters had mistakenly been given the wrong category envelope and when discovered was immediately corrected. We're currently investigating how this could have happened and deeply regret that this occurred. So now they ban like phones and stuff for those people. What about, you know, something else? Anthony Anderson on the After Party special seemed convinced it was a conspiracy. And Jimmy Kimmel's known for his pranks. Right? YouTube hoaxes, the twerking girl on fire, the wolf at the Sochi Olympics, urging parents to pretend they ate their kids' Halloween candy, holiday prank war with John Krasinski and Emily Blunt. So maybe he did that. Maybe it's Matt Damon. Because throughout the entire ceremony, Jimmy Kimmel mercilessly teased Damon. Towards the end of the show, the announcer referred to Damon as Ben Affleck's guest when they presented an award, and music played over Damon when he started talking. So maybe Matt Damon did it. I don't know. But I hope you guys enjoy the show tonight, and obviously on the site tomorrow there'll be blind items until the sun goes down. I'll talk to you guys later.